Blog Talk Radio.
Muscle aches, rashes.
To find an answer.
Hair loss. I'm so tired.
You need to ask your doctor the right question.
Could I have lupus?
For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on twitter.com/joykeys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just check me out there. Look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And I'm also on Instagram. Check me out there. Tag me in a photo. You might win a prize. You guys know I give away books and CDs and Starbucks gift cards, all types of things. So definitely follow, tweet, you know, Facebook, whatever, and you might win a prize. Today I'll be giving away a book. So you want to follow later on after the show to see how to win a copy of the book. And also later on, I'll be giving away a download from iTunes. So again, definitely check me out on iTunes, on Twitter and Facebook or Instagram to see how you can win. Well, today I am speaking with an author across the pond, as they say. and she is a daughter of a very famous activist, environmental activist, Ken Sarawiwa, from Nigeria, but she has come into her own with her book, Looking for Trans Wonderland, Travels in Nigeria. She has written a wonderful travel book about all different parts of Nigeria, not just the regular Lagos area you might think about, but on the outskirts and looking at different ethnic groups, historical, you know, artifacts, mountains, different ways of transportation, all types of things. So today I speak with Noor Sarawiwa. She's all the way in London. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good morning. Afternoon.
Thank you again. Oh, thank you again for, you know, taking the time to speak with me today. Your book is just, wow, it's so detailed, so entrancing. And again, as I mentioned before, it draws me in, like, I want to go to Nigeria now, but then I don't want to go to Nigeria now. Like, I'm nervous, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what Nigeria is about. You know, you don't go there just to purely have a good time. You go there for an experience, you know, and it can be, you know, life-changing and really change your perspective. And for me, that's what travel is about. You know, I'm not going just to rest my feet and just have a really wonderful, relaxing time. You know, I just go there to learn and observe and just, you know, have a real experience.
Well,
and
definitely.
Nigeria definitely gives you that.
Yeah, definitely you had a real experience. I mean, you were not living the high life the whole time. I mean, you were no electricity, you know, going to get your water, and then other times, you know, going to the refrigerator and lounging on the sofa watching cable TV. So you had the you know,
yeah,
gamut. You ran the gamut of different travel experiences and how different, you know, people live. But let's start at the beginning,
yeah,
of, you know, why are you a writer? You know, why are you writing? Why are you not doing something else like law or medicine or, you know, I don't know, being a police officer? Why did you become a writer?
I don't know. I just think I've always wanted, I just like writing. I love travel and I love writing. And I started off thinking, oh, let me be a journalist, you know, like a foreign correspondent. But then, you know, a year at journalism school at Columbia in New York made me realize that no, I wanted to be, you know, a kind of travel writer and just, you know, exploring the human race, but through, you know, everyday travels rather than, you know, hard news in geopolitics. And I guess, you know, I like cultural anthropology in a way. You know, I like to understand the world, and I found that some, you know, certain travel books I've read in the past really inspired me and, you know, illuminated the, you know, things about certain societies. And so, yeah, I wanted to do the same. The fact that my father was a writer actually had no bearing on that. People often think that, you know, you're following in your father's footsteps. But, you know, I didn't actually realize I wanted to be a writer until I was 25. And it really was the culmination of, you know, just recognizing my different strengths and different interests and putting them all together in this particular way. So, yeah, I, you know, for me, it's just the perfect niche. It just suits me right down to the ground.
So what do you think you've learned about yourself in traveling? What's something that you said, you know, wow, I didn't know that was how I was going to react or, you know, what I was capable of? What's something that you've learned about yourself in all these travels?
Well, I know that while I sort of worry about the risks of things, I find that my curiosity will just take me anywhere, you know. And I realize that now. I always start off a journey thinking, oh, I mustn't go to this place, and I mustn't do this, and I mustn't do that. And like when I was in Lagos, for example, you know, I had this policy I set for myself at the beginning of the trip, never to carry my visa card unless I actually, you know, really had to, and never take my camera. And then, you know, I found myself doing that. And you just wake up and it's like, well, I need my camera, you know, and I need to, you know. And so you just find yourself doing things out of necessity. I never allow, you know, fear to get in the way of that. But on the other hand, I realized that actually I'm a real coward when it comes to, you know, revealing certain aspects of myself. So, like, Nigeria is a really religious place, and I'm not religious. And I felt like, you know, I have to be in a closet about these things. And I was really shocked at that, you know, because in England, I'm completely different. You know, if a you know, Jehovah's Witness or someone comes to my doorstep and wants to, you know, sell me their product, as it were, you know, I always have a few words, you know, to say to them, and I engage in a debate. But I found that when I was in Nigeria, I was, you know, I was terrified of admitting that, you know, I'm not this religious person. I don't go to church, and so, you know, my aunt confronted me about it, and you know, I just sort of curled up into a ball metaphorically, and I'm really shocked at that, you know. So I was thinking, you know, that I'm a real fighter by nature, and you know, it turns out that I'm very argumentative when it comes to taxi fares and things like that. But when it comes to big things like religion and whatnot, I'm quite pathetic. So, but that was then. You know, I've learned from that.
Yeah. Well, talking about religion, one of the things that your book delves into is the mass bloom of Christianity. And a particular strict form of Christianity, and people getting mega churches in Nigeria. Talk to the audience a little bit about what you learned there about this development and the massive amount of people involved in.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, Nigeria is very roughly speaking split. You know, the north is Muslim and the south is Christian. And, but, you know, over the years, this very sort of charismatic style Pentecostal Christianity has taken hold. And this, you know, it started really in the 80s when the IMF imposed, you know, sort of structural adjustment program. So the government had to cut spending and unemployment went up. And things got really tough for people. And around that time, you had Nigerians who'd been based in the U.S. coming back to Nigeria and importing American-style charismatic, prophet kind of driven Christianity. And you know, the people really took to it in Nigeria. You know, it's poverty and desperation. And when you live in a society like Nigeria, when you're dealing with these governments, and at the time, military governments, you know, so corrupt and just so, you know, unyielding in their disregard for the population, you know, you will turn to anything. And, you know, and that's what happened. But also, you know, because the economy wasn't doing well, Christianity became a route for entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. So you've got this, you know, proliferation of churches. And, you know, don't get me wrong, there were some very good churches in Nigeria doing really good things. And, you know, the spiritual aspect of Christianity, you know, is a wonderful thing and it really helps people. But there's this kind of material side, and you have these charlatans, you know, who take advantage of people's vulnerability and desperation. And so they'll set up churches, and you can go to, you know, any street in Nigeria, including the residential street where my family has a house, and you'll find, you know, church after church. And when I was a child, there were no churches on that street. You go down, you see all these signs everywhere, and you know, it's become sort of big business. And, you know, the preachers are very charismatic. You know, they're wearing sort of white, beauty suits. And, you know, they're dollar millionaires. They have private jets, everything. And it's just, you know, if you go onto YouTube, you will see just some ridiculous videos, just, you know, of these preachers and the things they get up to in their church services. And, you know, the whole thing is just, it's rife for exploitation, you know, for sexual abuse, for financial fraud, everything. And so for me, I have real difficulty with that aspect of things. And, you know, I just found that it was everywhere. And, you know, you're traveling on a bus and you see someone reading a book, and you're like, oh, you know, they're reading a book. And you read over their shoulder, and then you see that it's nearly always a religious book. You know?
Yeah.
I see more people reading Manda Adichie's books in London than you do, you know, in Nigeria. So, you know, there's a cultural Philistinism that comes with this kind of excessive focus on religion, and I really struggle with that, you know, personally.
You know, it's funny because it happens in other places in the world. You know, for example, in Brazil, there was a large influx of the church coming in and trying to, you know, convert people, and also a strict form of, you know, Catholicism, that was, running through the different favelas, you know, and making people give their money up, but they barely could eat. So it happens all over the world, this turning toward religion. For a light, if you will, in their life. But at the same time, then people use that light to suck the light out of people. You know what I mean? Like, it happens all over, you know? Why am I giving all this money? Exactly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the Catholic Church in Europe centuries ago, exactly the same thing, and that's what Protestantism was born out of. It was, you know, trying to get rid of this, you know, corruption and people paying priests money in exchange for forgiveness, you know. And it's always a danger, and it happens everywhere. And right now, it's happening very intensely in Nigeria.
Now, one of the things you find out in your travels is you're going and you're looking at these different places, museums and artifacts, and the fact that they are in ruins, unfortunately. Here in America, if I go, I can go to beautiful museums, things are really kept, I can't even touch, get close. And in your experience, you were able to, like, get up close and feel and breathe and all, so to speak. What do you think is going to happen? Is it going to continue to fall apart? And is there anybody there fighting to get these, you know, artifacts noticed? Or is it just going to continue to fall apart? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that a lot of our best artifacts aren't even in Nigeria anymore anyway. You know, the British, when they destroyed the Empire of Benin at the very late 19th century, they took a lot of the best specimens back to Europe. And so if you actually want to see the best of the Benin bronzes, you go to the British Museum, or you go to the Louvre, or you go to the Ethnographic Museum in Berlin. That's got amazing specimens from all over Africa. And so what we have left isn't, you know, amazing, but it's real, it's there. Looking after museums are like infrastructure. It's all part of the same thing. If the government neglects its electricity and its roads, education, then it's going to neglect its museums as well. It's all part of the same thing. So you can't really call for the government to improve museums. You know, you have to wait for an improvement everywhere else first.
Right.
So, it is, you know, it's a real problem. But, you know, there are Nigerians who are really interested in the history and our artifacts and whatnot. And you've got writers like Maurice Archibong, who's a really good travel writer for a newspaper. I think it's the Sun newspaper in Nigeria. And he travels around a lot writing about these things. And you've got writers like Tenu Aluetu, he's on Twitter. And he's always going around, you know, different places in Nigeria and writing about all these tourist hotspots. He's a real advocate of that sort of thing. So, you know, you have people out there who, are trying to, who have concerns about this sort of thing who write about it and inform Nigerians, you know, about our cultural heritage. You've also got like websites from like the CBD Institute, which is run by a woman called Oregisu, and that's really good as well. And you know, she's on a mission to, you know, gather all of Nigeria's, you know, sort of cultural memories, photographic,
right,
as well as written and everything. So yeah, there are people out there doing stuff. So, you know, you need the government ultimately to, you know, to really participate,
to make a
change. Control.
Talking about the government, you visited. Your brother is working. Is it okay to in the government? And I guess was it your cousin who had an office in the building near? And the talk about the strike difference.
My brother had an office.
Your brother had an office.
It's, you know, you look around Nigeria. And it's so, you know, the infrastructure is terrible, and you know, and things just barely function. But then you go to the presidential offices in Abuja, the capital city, and it's a whole different story. It's just, it's so ironic, you know, that the people who preside over the mess that is Nigeria, you know, their offices are spanking new. We've got these kind of white neo-Islamic buildings, beautiful, you know, shiny cars, 4x4 cars everywhere. But then actually, you know, when I visited my brother's office, it was actually quite shabby, and I was like, what's going on here? You know, changing and damp and everything. And he was like, well, you know, this is a budget that I'm given, you know, as part of, under the River State government gives me. And I thought, well, hang on, why are you being funded by, you know, River State, which is the state that our family comes from,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, his job is actually was at the time, you know, an assistant to the president's advisor on environmental affairs. You know, he's got his
which
job
is all of Nigeria, right? Not just office. The River State.
Mm. Yeah, but you know, ethnicity is so ingrained in Nigerian society that even if you work for the federal government in the capital city, you're still expected to be funded by the government of whichever region you come from. I mean, you know, can you imagine Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, working in Washington, but all her salary and her office being funded by the Illinois state government because she's a
mm-hmm.
member of the Chicago area. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. And, you know, so that's what it's like in Nigeria. And, yeah, you know.
It's amazing that people don't lose their minds. I'm sorry, say that again. I was just going to say that it's amazing that people don't lose their minds, especially people who are very well educated, because you go to the university, if I'm pronouncing Ibadan, if I'm pronouncing correctly,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, there are young people there, they're vibrant,
mm-hmm.
and they are trying to learn and better themselves, and they seem hopeful, you know, amongst, even they don't
mm-hmm.
have
mm-hmm.
facilities, but they're like, yeah, we're hopeful, yeah, we're doing what we have to do here. Is
yeah.
anybody losing
well,
their mind, though?
Well, I mean, you kind of just have to be very positive in Nigeria. If you have the positive outlook that I have, you won't survive. You know, you've got to wake up in the morning and believe that you can improve your situation. And that's what Nigerians are very good at, you know. And some people use religion to do it. Other people, you know, are just born with this kind of innate strength and positivity, and you know, and they find a way to, you know, they all have jobs, you know, second jobs, third jobs. They, you know, everyone has a sideline, a hustle.
Yeah. But then, like your cousin, she didn't get paid for 5 months. Your cousin, she didn't get paid for 5 months. There was a part
yeah.
in there, and
yeah.
other people are working. They're going to work, but they don't get paid. And I've read this in other books and other conversations, and I'm like, I can't imagine myself going to work for months and months at a time and not getting any money, and then, you know, how do you survive? And that's how they survive. People have third and fourth jobs and borrowing money from
yeah.
people. You know, it's very difficult for
why,
me. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, and that's why when you go to an office in Nigeria, you know, when you're dealing with Nigerian bureaucracy or anything, you go into a hotel, and you know, the workers just come across as very lackluster. You know, and it's
mm-hmm.
they just don't want to do the work. They're shuffling their feet, you know, It's very easy to make a very lazy assumption that they themselves are being lazy, but it's not. You know, they're not incentivized. You know, in the developed world, every boss will tell you that they incentivize their workers with bonuses and, you know, salaries. And so, you know, in Nigeria, when people aren't getting bonuses, they're not even getting their salaries. It only makes sense that they're not going to, you know, be doing their jobs, you know, with 100% enthusiasm. You know, or
Let's talk about the title. We're getting close to our time. Trans World. Talk to the audience about what that means.
Looking for Trans Wonderland.
Wonderland. I'm sorry, Trans Wonderland.
Yeah, well, Trans Wonderland is the name of an amusement park. It was kind of the guy that described it as Nigeria's answer to Disneyland. So I thought, oh, this is exciting. So I went there, and you know, it was just typically Nigerian in that it was, you know, run down. There was like tall grass growing everywhere, and not many people around. And I just, you know, I thought, oh, okay, there's nothing going on here. but actually, it was still functioning. You know, the manager there said, well, you know, just point to a ride that you want, and I'll press the button. And, you know, anyway, so this, you know, this amusement park was just basically quite decrepit. And in a way, it's a metaphor. You know, it symbolizes what Nigeria, for me, was about during that trip. That's what Nigeria is all about. It's this kind of potential, but, you know, a dereliction. And but I went to Nigeria because I wanted to sort of get rid of the demon, you know, that I had over that country. You know, my father was murdered along with 8 of his colleagues in 1995 by the military dictatorship. And so, you know, apart from going back to his funeral, I didn't go anywhere near Nigeria for years. And so, you know, I was looking for a different side of Nigeria in my trip. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just experience the country in a different way. I wanted to see, you know, the tourist attractions, the rivers, the mountains, the gorillas, the amusement parks. You know, so Trans Wonderland is a metaphor. It, you know, symbolizes that other side of Nigeria. But, you know, when I arrived at Trans Wonderland, you know, I found that the actual amusement park itself was a symbol of Nigeria in that, you know, it was being left derelict. And, you know, just slightly disappointing and frustrating in that respect, but potentially so beautiful and amazing.
Yes, and one of the other parts you had gone to, the island where the slave quarters were and on the beaches, and you talked about how there had been a great festival there. And there was a rock putting the date, and there were spaces for future years, and there was no more future years because it got shut down because somebody tried to take over it and make money off of it illegally, you know? That's the type of thing that's happening, you know? It's like that wonderful, beautiful experience that could be right there at the tip of the tongue, so to speak, and then it just falters for whatever reason, mainly due to corruption.
Tainted because, one person, one or two people need to make money, you know, at everyone else's expense. And, it's just, that is Nigeria in a nutshell. And, it's sad because that festival, Festac, was really, it was amazing. And if you go to the Antigone Institute website, you know, you'll see photos of it from the 70s. It was great.
So now let me ask you, as a traveler, what do you not leave home without? What do you have to have in your purse, in your pocket, on your body when you go traveling?
Actually, it's my moisturizer, all that kind of stuff, you know, sort of my hair moisturizer,
no special pocket knife or anything like that. No special camera.
I have to have a camera. These days I have to have a phone because, you know, that's where I record conversations on and everything.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. So basically, as long as I have my laptop, my phone, my hair moisturizer, then I'm fine. You know,
you're good to go.
That's all I need.
So now, if somebody's going to go to Nigeria, where should they start? Should they start in Lagos, or should they start on the outer edges, looking, going to the animal wild reserves, or where should they start if they're going to go to Nigeria?
Yeah, I would definitely start in Lagos. I mean, 10 years ago, I might have suggested actually starting in Abuja. Actually, you could still start there. Abuja is much quieter, and you know, and it's just very easy to get around. Either way. Yeah, but let's say start in Lagos, because, you know, Lagos is amazing. It's got everything. It's got extreme poverty, extreme wealth. It's a real party town, you know, great restaurants, jazz clubs, book groups, you know, it's just aspect, you know, certain aspects of it are just, you know, are very functional. So, yeah, you know, most people who go to Lagos, you know, tell you they have a really good time. Yeah, so you go there, you know, check out, if you go to Cross River State in the southeast, that's really good. It's, you know, it's the most well-run place in terms of tourist infrastructure. You've got a sanctuary in a forest where you've still got gorillas and chimpanzees. Calabar itself, so it's a really nice town by the Cross River. And the Cross River has a lot of cultural significance because slaves came down from there, particularly the Igbo ethnic group, and, you know, a lot of Americans, Brazilians, and particularly people from the Caribbean, you know, have Igbo ancestry. And so, you know, chances are, if you go to Calabar, you'll be on the river where one of your ancestors came down. And it's beautiful. You know, it's like fringed with palm trees and mangroves, and, you know, you can take rides on the boats. So, yeah, you know, I would go to Lagos. I would go to, you could just do those two things and spend time in Nigeria and, you know, a really good time.
Now, one of the interesting things, and we have a couple minutes left, is you talked about the Brazilians in Nigeria, which was something I wasn't aware of. And at one point you were saying there was like 10%, I think it was 5 or 10%, were Brazilian. And so that was a very interesting historical I did not know anything about. And that's what you were just saying about.
Yeah, you have some Brazilians who returned to Nigeria in the same way that some Americans returned to Liberia. And, you know, they were free slaves, and they built, you know, Brazilian-style, Portuguese-style architecture, which you can still see in Lagos, although it's, you know, it's crumbling a little bit. And you're still, you know, there are people in Lagos who have names like Da Silva and things like that, you know. And so, it's all kind of there, and... So that's why I find really interesting. Go to Brazil, you see so much Nigerian culture in Brazil, and then, you know, they brought that back. It sort of came full circle in the very late 19th century. But again, you know, you really have to, like, look for it. It's not...
But it's still an interesting note that we're all connected in so many ways. Like, we think we're isolated on this little, you know, country, and then this continent, and then there's big ocean. But actually, we still are connected, even though these large waters are in between the different continents and things. So I think it was just an interesting, you know, note in there. Now, lastly but not least, is one of the things that your father fought for is dealing with the oil companies. And that is why, you know, he was fighting, because they were destroying the lands around where your people came from, the Ogoni people. So I just wanted to mention that to the audience, you know, and that's still going on, you know, in there. Do you feel that it's better today than it was when your father was fighting about it, or it's the same?
No, I think it's, I mean, it's, you know, obviously the oil companies have to be more mindful now of, you know, respecting the environment. You know, the government doesn't push them as much.
Yeah,
but, you know, there's a global awareness of the issue now, so that's, you know, a great legacy of my father's campaign.
I just want to thank you so much for coming on today, and I know that you're going to be writing another book for us for some other place so that we can read your delicious writing. And I hope that you'll come back on. No, it was really a great read. Like I said, it drew me in. It pushed me away. It made me think. You know, I learned some new things. You know, about you know, like, say, Brazilians coming back there, and the different artifacts and things of that nature. But also, you gave a nice historical kind of like an overlay. You know, along with your daily travels, you brought up historical things that were going on. So I just want to thank you so much, and I hope you have a great weekend. Thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for inviting me. Great talking to you.
Okay, well, I will talk to you soon, okay?
All right.
Have a nice day. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope that you will follow her website is NOOSAROWIWA. Again, NOOSAROWIWA.com. And also she's on Twitter with the same name, and you can follow her there and learn more about where she's going to be traveling. I'll be giving away a copy of her book, Looking for Trans Wonderland, Travels in Nigeria. So follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Become a fan on Facebook and check me out on Instagram. Stay tuned. I'll be speaking with Laurel Howery from The Carmichael Show next.
Muscle aches, rashes.
To find an answer.
Hair loss. I'm so tired.
You need to ask your doctor the right question.
Could I have lupus?
For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.